The following live presentation by Rabbi Benny Friedman is brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To learn more about Israelite, please visit our website at www.israelite.org. Additional contact information is available at the end of this presentation. Thank you for learning with Israelite and enjoy the experience.
This week is the portion of Vayishlach, okay? And there are so many different pieces to this week's portion, so many different stories, just so we all have the same background. Yaakov is on his way back. If you remember, those of you who were on board last week, Yaakov leaves the house of his father, running from his brother Esav, having basically connived his way into the blessings, and that's an interesting discussion, but for another time. We actually wrote a parasha about that. And spends the last 22 years away, and under very difficult circumstances, and goes down dreaming about ladders and angels, and comes back because he's been dreaming about sheep. And when you start dreaming about sheep, it's time to come home. And he sets out on the journey in the middle of the night. His father-in-law, who is perceived in Jewish literature and tradition as the epitome of cunning and deceit. In fact, his name is Lavan. Lavan means white. That's the kind of falsehood that you don't see coming, because it disguises itself, you know, with a white hat on. And Yaakov survives all this. And both of his wives, his family, they set out on the journey. And after 22 long years, Yaakov is finally coming home, okay? And he gets into the land of Israel, and something changes. And that's really where you sort of pick up this week's portion, right? One of the most painful experiences that I actually ever had in the Israeli army had nothing to do with combat or being in the field. It actually transpired during a moment of relative calm, when things were looking pretty good. We were at the tail end of my first official reserve duty. This was back in '88, and it was a very harrowing month. The Israeli army was completely unprepared for the first intifada. You know, you put a unit of tanks opposite enemy tanks, at least they know what to do. But you know, put us in alleyways facing civilians, children throwing rocks, Molotov cocktails. The tension of not knowing what's going to happen next. We were actually stationed in Jabalia, which is an area in the Gaza Strip. It's a nasty little piece of real estate. It's one of the most densely populated places in the world. I was a young officer. It was my first reserve duty. I was actually one of the first soldiers, one of the few soldiers in the unit with a kippah on his head, for whatever that's worth. And I was called up during the first months of the Intifada, and, you know, I can't even begin to tell you sort of the tensions of that experience. You know, in addition to everything else, just not knowing how you're going to perform under pressure, the prospect of commanding men who, you know, had joined the army back for, you know, when for me it was a good year for milk, was also a cause of no small amount of concern. It's kind of like when you finish grade school and you go to high school. So one year you're on top of the world, you're in eighth grade, and you're the king. And then the next year you're a freshie, right? You're in ninth grade, and you're at the bottom of the barrel again. And that's how you feel. You know, you just finished your 3-4 years of regular army. You get your second lieutenant's bar. You know the ropes. You've been commanding your guys for who knows how long. And all of a sudden now, you're serving with guys who are Yom Kippur war veterans. And you don't really sort of know how to find your feet. It takes a while. And as such, the fact that I happened to be one of the few guys in the unit, in this new reserve duty unit that I was in, who I guess you could say was whatever label you want to use, religious, committed to Jewish tradition, you know, really was an issue for me, especially after a few years in the regular army. And I assumed that these conditions would be more or less similar to the regular army. But in truth, reserve duty is an entirely different experience. And it took some of the men a while to get used to an officer who would not necessarily eat everything they did, and who had certain limitations, for example, on Shabbat. And none of us really had a lot of time to discuss these issues, as the month, which was spent mostly in, you know, the Gaza Strip, proved to be one of the most intense experiences at least I ever had in the army. And at the end of this month, on the last night of our reserve duty, all the guys got together for a party to celebrate the, I guess, successful completion of our mission of a month of reserve duty. And especially the fact that with everything going on, that none of the guys were injured and everybody was going home safe and sound. And, you know, by the third week of reserve duty, I had already fallen into the custom of making Kiddush Friday night for the whole battalion, and got to a point where I was giving them a Dvar Torah, Thought of Torah, right? My first weekly Teletorah was actually, you know, from the back of a Jeep. And I was nonetheless, even though I was starting to find my groove, I was totally taken by surprise when one of the guys in charge of organizing this final party told me that the men had decided that for the first time in the unit's history, they were going to make sure that the meat for the barbecue on the last night was going to be kosher so that I could eat with them. And it was, you know, to me, it was a very moving request, because to me, that's, I mean, that's what having a Jewish army is all about. And, you know, you feel good, like, you know, this sort of meeting of minds and different perspectives. And, you know, in the middle of the party, I mean, they brought a couple bottles of wine and somebody stopped and asked me to speak and whatever. And I thought this was great. And the master sergeant hands me a cup of wine and asks me to make a l'chaim and to offer one last thought before all the guys sort of split up the next morning. And, you know, it's difficult to describe how moving it is to be sitting amidst an entire battalion of combat soldiers who were becoming close friends. And, you know, over the next 10, 15 years, some of us became very close, sharing Torah as a commander after my first successful reserve duty. And, you know, to be, I mean, after 2,000 years, part of a Jewish army, sharing the privilege of Jewish tradition while fighting for the Jewish people in the land of Israel, you know, I mean, images of the Maccabees filled my mind, right? And it's only against the backdrop of this perception, this the feeling that I was having, that I can explain the incredible, I guess, disappointment that I experienced a few moments later. As the evening wound down and the food was finished, so a van pulled up and the rear doors opened up. And a couple of the guys, you know, sort of pulled out a big white screen and they hooked it up to a projector, to a generator, and they had actually hired this guy to come with a van and to show a portable movie. Now, mind you, this was long before, you know, the advent of laptops and DVDs. Everybody turned their chairs around to face the movie screen, and they began to show what turned out to be a blue movie, right? So, I mean, my mouth fell open. I doubt anybody noticed. They were too busy watching the athletics on the screen. So I just walked away. I didn't want to, you know, I wasn't in a position to do anything about it, and I didn't want to sit and watch and didn't want to say anything, you know, got to respect everybody's right to have their, live their life according to their own choosing. And I still remember the feeling of sitting alone in my tent, my naivete completely shattered, confronting the realization of just how far away we still were from the dream of what a Jewish army could be. Now, just to be clear, I have never and still don't believe in judging other people. Everybody has a right to their perception and beliefs, and, you know, if a group of guys, after putting their lives on the line for a month, if that's how they want to wind down, you know, they're entitled. That's, you know, everybody's got to find his own speed. You know, certainly the idea of imposing religious beliefs and practices on anybody isn't only anathema to me personally. I think it's one of the single most destructive forces in Israel today. That's another discussion. But the next morning, one of the guys would not let it go, and he wanted to know why I hadn't stayed at the party, which resulted, by the way, in a fascinating discussion on the topic. And his conviction was that the blue movie was actually a fulfillment of the dream of the Jewish people, and that stays with me till this day. He said, after all, what do we sing in the HaTikvah, right? He said, we sing Liot Am Chofshi Be'artzeinu. That's the last line, Liot Am Chofshi, to be a free people. And the fact that we are free to see and do as we like after 2,000 years of everybody else's rules, that's what it's all about. That's what he said. Is that really the Jewish dream? I mean, is that what we waited for so long? How did we come so far and yet lose what seems to be such a crucial piece of what the struggle was all about in the first place? So maybe this week's portion, Vayishlach, contains a clue to the nature of this challenge. And then we can open it up to discussion, you know, sort of when we get this idea out. After 22 years in the house of Lavan, Yaakov is finally on his way home. But he has one obstacle that he has yet to overcome before he can settle down to the task of creating a family that will ultimately become the Jewish people. he has to confront his brother Esav, who is headed his way with 400 fighting men. Now understand that 400 fighting men in the time of the Bible is a huge force. Huge. I mean, when you consider the population of the world at the time, and the sizes of the armies, and there's actually a lot of archaeological evidence to this, you're talking about the equivalent today of thousands of men. And, you know, Yaakov is told that they're coming his way. Now remember that the last time Yaakov had some kind of connection with Esav, he was running away from his home 22 years earlier because Esav had told him that, that he was going to kill him because he sort of, you know, subverted the blessings, stole the blessings. And beyond that, Esav in Jewish tradition represents in many ways the antithesis of everything the Jewish people are meant to be, right? Where Yaakov is about a belief in the world to come and the idea that there's a consequence to all that we do, Esav is about the here and now and the idea that this world is all you get, right? Where Yaakov is about monotheism and the objective, unimpeachable morality that is the direct result of a belief in one higher authority, Esav is about what, you know, sort of might makes right. And the excitement of immersion in the physical world with all its appetites and lures. When Yaakov is making a bowl of soup, right, a porridge, and Yaakov says to him, you know, if you're hungry and you want my soup, give me the birthright, which represents mitzvot and represents responsibility. And Esav says, Hinei ani olech lamut, v'lama zali b'chora, I'm going to die. In other words, so one way of understanding that line, Hinei anochi olech lamut v'lama zeh li. And what is this to me? The word zeh, which Esav says, is reminiscent of the same word used years later at the splitting of the sea. When the Jewish people in awe at the splitting of the Red Sea say, zeh keli v'anvehu, this is my God and I will adorn him. Right? So zeh represents, or it alludes according to Jewish tradition, to sort of that which I can't quite put my fingers on. That's that which is beyond my control. The fact that it's not about sort of the here and now. And Esav says, Lama Zeli, what do I need that for? It doesn't interest me. Right? Indeed, in the existential struggle, Yaakov is a constant reminder to Esav of a higher morality. And the idea that might does not necessarily make right. Right? Is that accidental, by the way, and we've spoken about this before, some of us, that Hitler, in Mein Kampf, articulates quite clearly the fact that his determination to destroy every last vestige of the Jewish people stems in no small part from his absolute refusal to forgive us for introducing this idea of one God and one objective morality to the world. Right? Hitler's desire to build a world based on a master race and survival of the fittest could only reign supreme with every last vestige of this morality represented by the Jewish people, right, when it was excised from the world. And Yaakov understands this. And recognizing the inherent dangers of such a confrontation with Esav, Yaakov splits his camp in two, reasoning that if one is destroyed, the other will survive. And that all makes sense. And there's a whole world of discussion there as well, that you don't sort of wait for God to do miracles, you have to do your bit. And then all of a sudden, inexplicably, he is left all alone between the two camps in the middle of the night. Vayivater Yaakov levado, right? He's left all alone. And he encounters a man, an angel, something, with whom he struggles all alone until dawn, right? Vayavek ish imo ad alot hashachar. And he struggles, he does battle with this man, and we're not sure who this man is, until dawn. Now, many interpretations have been offered as to the nature of Yaakov's foe, including the idea found in the Midrash that Yaakov is waging battle with no less than the prince or war angel or energy of the nation of Esav. Right? Sarosh el Esav. Yaakov is doing battle with what the world of Esav represents. Esav is coming his way. Esav has remained in Israel. The dream of what the land of Israel is meant to be as an environment for the creation of an ethical people is at stake here. And that's what Yaakov's doing battle with on a certain level. Right? It is then the quintessential battle between the forces of evil. In fact, Esav is the grandfather of Amalek, the nation which represents, in Jewish tradition, the attempt to destroy the Jewish people for no other reason than they are Jews. Rav Soloveitchik points out that, in his belief, Nazi Germany was the modern-day embodiment of Amalek, of this ancient form of evil. And this was Yaakov's spiritual struggle with all that Esav, his evil brother, represented. And the Torah, by the way, is purposely vague as to whether this was indeed a physical struggle or a spiritual one, or perhaps both. And then the dawn comes, and it appears that Yaakov has taken the day. Right? Victory is his. Right? V'lo yacholo. He can't overcome him. And it's very strange. All of the words are all pronouns, right? Vayavek ish imo adalot ha-shachar, right? Vayar ki lo yacholo, and he sees that he can't overcome him. And you're not sure who is seeing, who is being overcome, right? Initially, it's not clear. It's kind of like sort of the image of two men sort of struggling, and the dust clouds are kicking up, and you can't tell who's on top, right? The movie scene where the woman or somebody's holding the gun, but she's not sure what to do because she can't tell who's on top. Right? And this other, as we will find out, begs to take his leave, because Yaakov seems to have taken his day. But Yaakov will not let him go, right? At which point, this opponent, so it seems, grabs Yaakov along his inner thigh, his sciatic nerve, right, and attacks him, and causes the leg of Yaakov to buckle. And in the end, despite the victory, Yaakov limps away from the battle wounded. And it's at this point that the Torah concludes this story with what is an extremely puzzling comment. Right? This is in Perek Lamed Bet, Pasuk Lamed Bet. It's the 32nd chapter, the 32nd verse. Very easy to remember where to find this, because the number 32 in Jewish tradition is Lamed Bet, is Lev, is the heart. The word Lev means heart. Lamed represents 30. 2 is the second letter of the alphabet. So it's very easy to find this verse. Right? Al-Kain, therefore, the children of Israel will not eat of the Gidan Asher, of the sciatic nerve, right, on the thigh, until this day, Adayom Azeh, right? Because he touched the inner thigh of Yaakov and the sciatic nerve, right? Now, it's even today, we don't eat of the Gidan Asher, and this is true. If you go to a butcher, to kosher butcher, they cut out the Gidan Asher. In fact, it's an art to cut it out in such a way that it doesn't sort of, you know, mess up the cut of meat. And that's in memory of that day and that battle. What exactly is it that we're meant to learn from this added detail in the story? I mean, why is it that 4,000 years later, we are still cutting the sciatic nerve out of our kosher animals? Is it so critical to remember that wrestling match long ago? To remember the underhanded attempt of Yaakov's opponent? You know, he basically grabs him inside the thigh. I mean, what is this Gidan Asher that it plays such an important role, not only in the story, but in Jewish tradition forever? And further, by the way, if this Ish, whoever this Ish or whatever this Ish, this man was, who struggled with Yaakov, if he was, as the Midrash suggests, much more than a normal opponent, but somehow represents the energy of Esav, the embodiment of evil, in its attempt to destroy everything that Yaakov stood for, well then, why then was attacking the Gidan Asher so important? What exactly is this Gidan Asher, this sciatic nerve, all about? So, maybe a closer look at the word Nasheh. Okay, a gid is basically a tendon or a nerve. Okay? But what does it mean, gid ha-nasheh? Right? The nerve of nasheh. So Rashi explains that the word nasheh means that if the nerve, that this nerve somehow, right, nasha, it jumped out of its place. In other words, it was, the reason that it was so painful was because it's not clear, you have to look at Rashi, he ripped it out, he moved it out, right? In other words, nasheh, according to Rashi, refers to something being moved out of its natural place. And that's very interesting, because in fact, if you look at the story of Joseph, right, you know, years later when Yosef is in Egypt, and is already the viceroy of Pharaoh, and finally gets married, and begins to see sort of the turnaround of his whole story. So he names his first son Menasheh. Why? Ki nashani Elokim be'eretz ani. Right? So what does that mean? Right? For Hashem has taken me out of the land of my suffering. In other words, the Gid HaNasheh is the nerve that was moved out of its natural place. Okay? And you can see this in the Rashi, in Gidon Asher. Rashi says, hang on, let me just, 1 second. It says, V'lama nikra shmo Gidon Asher, says Rashi. Why is it called the Gidon Asher? L'fisha nashamim komo v'ala. V'hu lashon kfitza. It's a language of jumping. Right? So in other words, the Gidon Asher, right, is somehow the nerve that was moved from its natural place, maybe by the forceful blow of the angel. And the lesson that we're meant to carry to this day might then be the challenge of remembering who we are and where we are really meant to be, not just physically, but on a spiritual level as well. Now that's very interesting, that Hashem has taken me out of the land of my suffering, right? Yaakov names Yosef names his son Menashe because Nashani Elokim be'eretz Oni. God took me out, or moved me, in the land of my suffering. But that's an interesting question. Where was the land of his suffering? The land of his suffering was Egypt, but God has not taken him out of Egypt because he's still in Egypt. In fact, this son Menashe, interestingly enough, is the first Jew to be born in exile, when you really stop to think about it, because he's born in Egypt, he lives in Egypt, and he dies in Egypt. He never gets out. So he's the first quintessential Jew of the exile. So why did God take him out? One way of understanding it is that Yosef is saying that even though I'm here in Egypt, you've given me the ability to take myself out. Because it's not about where you are, it's about who you are. Okay? So that's one way of understanding Nashe. Right? That somehow maybe we're really meant to be not just physically, but on a spiritual level as well, remembering who we are. However, there is another way to understand this word. And this is very interesting. At the end of his life, in the final song that he sings to the Jewish people, in the portion known as Ha'azinu, right, which contains the essence of who and what we are meant to be as a people, Moshe, just before his death, says, Tzur Yaldecha Teshi, Vatishkach el mecholaleka. You ignored, right? Tzur yaldecha teshi. You ignored the rock, which probably refers to God, like Ma'oz Tzur, the rock of our salvation, right? Who bore you? And ultimately you forgot the God that brought you forth. That's in Dvarim, also chapter 32, in verse 18, right? In other words, teshi, which is the same root as neshi, as nashani, right? Is that we forgot, we ignored. And it's interesting that Rashi over there explains the phenomenon being described by Moshe as the time in the Jewish people's future when they would actively forget who they are and what their purpose was and is all about. Teshi then is to forget. And in this interpretation, Joseph's naming of his son Menashe might be taken to mean that God caused Joseph to forget his pain. Which makes a lot of sense, and actually makes even more sense when you think about where Yosef was at, right? And basically, the painful memories of what Yosef went through were essentially removed from his consciousness. In other words, rather than wallowing in the misery of being alone in a foreign land, seemingly abandoned by all those that he loved, you know, because Joseph was sold as a slave, he's thanking Hashem, he's thanking God for allowing him to let go of that pain and to move on in his life. And that's related to the idiom, which is found often in the Gemara, Fashash Kocho, or his strength abated, right? Which can either mean that his strength was removed, right? Which is sort of like the first interpretation that we offered, or that his strength was forgotten, right? Which is in sync with sort of the second thing that we say. Which leaves us with the question, why is this idea of forgetting so important that we continue to desist from this sciatic nerve of forgetfulness even today, right? And what does this all have to do with the struggle between Yaakov and Esav? Is this, either this is the nerve that the angel or that the man, whoever it was that Yaakov was doing battle with, forced out of its place, which is hence the pain, or it's the nerve with which sort of symbolizes that the opponent of Yaakov was trying to make Yaakov forget who he really was. If you think about it, in the midst of the struggle, if Yaakov is the dweller of tents, if his goal is not sort of the military and the army, but the world of Torah, then when you engage, when they engage us in battle, right, the danger is much more than who wins the battle. It's whether in the course of the battle I become my own worst enemy. Okay? And this, by the way, is a very interesting discussion in terms of what's going on in the world today. There's a whole discussion. Somebody actually who might even be on this call sent me an interesting email about a woman who was coming to speak concerning, you know, whether Israel in the Lebanon war had employed methods of, interrogation and, do we use torture to interrogate potential suicide bombers? And even though, I think that the gist of some of what, people sometimes say is completely mistaken, I think the question is a good question. The issue of whether we interrogate prisoners and whether we, sort of what we do and how we do it is not about whether we have the right to interrogate someone who could potentially be a suicide bomber or know a suicide bomber. That's not the question. The question is what it does to us and how we find the balance. How do you remain a Jewish army and not sort of fall prey to the very thing that you're doing battle against? And you could make a case for saying that that's part of what this is. So what is this sciatic nerve of forgetfulness? Right? Forgetfulness and the ability, and sometimes even the decision to forget, can be both a blessing and a curse. Right? I mean, on the one hand, without the ability to forget some of life's more painful and challenging experiences, we would have to live with all the pain and tragedy in our lives, as fresh as the moment we experienced it. I mean, 20 years later, I still remember, like it was yesterday, the exact moment, even the place, the newsstand in Mitzpeh Rimon, where I found out that one of my closest friends, Danny Moshitz, had been killed in ambush in Lebanon. I was in the middle of tank officer's course, and I still recall how difficult it was to even concentrate on what was going on in absolutely one of the most grueling and psychologically draining courses in the Israeli army. If I had remained in that state of pain and loss for the next few months, I never would have made it. But time heals all wounds, or at least it assuages them, and with time, Hashem lets you let go of the pain and put it in its proper place, and sometimes that's hard to imagine. There's someone on the phone here who tonight is commemorating the Yahrzeit of his father, Alav HaShalom. And, we're learning in memory of Yosef Michal ben Pesach HaLevi. And, one of the challenges of a Yahrzeit, of the day when you remember someone that you lost, is that for one day you actually try to go back there a little. And to remember who he was, and to remember all he gave to you, and to experience the sense of loss. But that's one day a year. And the challenge is to be sure that the rest of the year, you're not living with that sense of loss, you're actually living with the sense of gain. You're focusing on what this person gave you and not what was lost when he left this world. Right? And this is essentially the psychology, by the way, behind all of the Jewish mourning customs, where a person is first in a state of onen, or shock, at receiving the initial news of the loss of a loved one. And during that state of shock, there are all sorts of halachot there. You're not supposed to fulfill positive commandments. You have no obligation. But then after the burial, you sit Shiva, and you actually, during the traditional 7 days of mourning, are forced to sort of focus and even wallow in the pain of loss. But then once this 7 day period is concluded, a person enters the Shloshim, the 30 day period, which is lesser and yet not insignificant mourning, where the loved one is still on one's mind, with certain reminders to allow a person to continue mourning while gradually letting go, which is followed in the case of the loss of one's parents with the 11 month or almost years worth of mourning, wherein it's still on your mind and the Torah actually doesn't want you to let go of it, which is the normal course of events. Right? And eventually you mourn on the anniversary of the day of the death. When a person needs to take out one's pain as the years sort of allow one to gradually let go. And sometimes forgetting is not just a process we need to access, but first has to be a decision that we need to make. Somebody wrongs you in some real or perceived way. At what point do you decide to let it go? The ability to choose to ignore or let go of anger or pain or even embarrassment represents our ability to live life as healthy and balanced individuals. And here too, the process has to be a gradual one, right? You have to take into account, that you have to affirm that you've been wronged, and you have to balance that with the choice to let go and to move on. And it goes without saying that the ability to decide when and how to apply each stage in this process is one of life's greatest challenges, and one of the greatest skills in interpersonal relationships, right? The wisdom to know when to forget things that are worth forgetting, and when to remember things that need to be remembered. And that's why, by the way, the Mishnah in Ethics of the Fathers suggests that one should not attempt to calm a person in their anger, nor bring joy to a person in the initial intensity of their sorrow. Everything has its time. Sometimes we need to forget, and sometimes we need to be immersed in remembering. Even more fascinating, by the way, is the particular mitzvah of shikha, which is the forgotten sheaves, right? If you are harvesting your field, wheat that is accidentally forgotten behind in the fields or on the threshing floor during the harvest is forbidden to its owners and it belongs to the poor. And that mitzvah suggests that when we forget something, it was meant to be forgotten. Which might as well imply that when we remember or reaccess something, it's because we were meant to rediscover it. However, as much as forgetting can be a positive process, shikha or forgetting can also be destructive and even dangerous. And maybe that's what Moshe was talking about in his address to the Jewish people at the end of his life. Tzur yaldecha teshi, vatishkach kel mechol aleka. You ignored God, and so ultimately you forgot him. There are times when we actively decide to forget what we know deep down we really should remember. That's a forgetting that's more like ignoring. When you choose to remove someone or something from your lives, from your attention, right? A good example of this is the case of the butler, whose dream Joseph correctly interpreted while he was in prison, and who was subsequently released and restored to his former position in Pharaoh's court. And he should have, in gratitude to Joseph, remembered to alert Paro to Joseph's plight. In fact, Joseph, after interpreting his dream, and certainly from the butler's perspective being a part of his redemption, Joseph says, "Remember me to Pharaoh." But the pasuk says, "Velo zachar sara mashkim et Yosef, va yishkacheu," and the butler does not remember Joseph and forgets him. And of course, the rabbis point out that that's rather a superfluous repetition. I mean, if the butler didn't remember Joseph, then obviously he forgot him. Unless the Torah is trying to tell me that this was not just an inadvertent slip of the memory, but a conscious choice to forget him. And by the way, that is really the beginning of the Egyptian exile, which itself forms the paradigm for all exile and for how anti-Semitism often rears its ugly head. You know, you kind of wonder how a paro could not know about Joseph, right? What does it say, Vayakam Melech Hadash al Mitzrayim, at the beginning of Exodus, the introduction to the story of our enslavement, and a new king arose over Egypt, Ashalo Zacharet Yosef, who did not remember Joseph. How could paro not know about Joseph, who had just saved the entire country? Never mind rising to the second highest position in all of Egypt. That would be like the United States president forgetting, I don't know, who Colin Powell or Stormin Norman Schwarzkopf was a few years after the Gulf War. Right? There is a power to that. Unless, of course, Paro was deliberately choosing to forget Joseph. Because that was the first stage in a process that was designed to delegitimize the entire Jewish population. Much, by the way, as the Germans conveniently forgot all of the Jewish veterans who fought for Germany in World War I. And what Moshe was referring to in his dire warning to the Jewish people just before their entrance into the land of Israel was the danger inherent in the Jewish people forgetting who they really are. And our enemies have always understood exactly what this is, right? In fact, Rav Ephraim Ashri, who we've spoken about before, one of the last rabbis of the Kovno ghetto, who published a collection of responsum called Mima Makim, From the Depths, in which he had given answers to some of the most difficult and challenging questions that he was asked during his time in the ghetto. So in one particular responsum, he says that a Jew came to him prior to Yom Kippur to ask whether he should make a blessing over food on Yom Kippur if he was forced to eat. Right? Apparently the Nazis would give the Jews extra rations on only one day of the year, Yom Kippur. They knew it was a fast day. And they wanted to make the Jews eat, both to cause them more suffering, as well as to undermine what little joy was left, what little sense of purpose was left to the Jewish people. And this policy, which was widespread in the Nazi Empire, was not about physical destruction, right? It was the Nazis understood that the secret to Jewish continuity has never been about the physical, but about spiritual growth. And they knew intuitively that if they could cause us to forget our roots and our Torah, we would be easy game. Which, of course, is what is so challenging about where we are as a people today. Because we are doing the work of the Nazis for them. You know? We once had a student, an Israelite, who was sharing how he ended up deciding to come to Israel and to, sort of studying an Israelite in Jerusalem. He was sitting in a college course on, I think, Near Eastern religions, and the professor, in the midst of his lecture, referred to the Jewish people as the people of the book. And he realized that although he was part of the people of the book, he didn't know what the book the professor was referring to. Much less had he ever opened the book. So he decided to come to Israel to explore the book that everybody was talking about. How many Jews today in America, in the world, have ever opened up that book? much less seriously explored the beauty of its content. Right? There's a Mishnah in Pirkei Avot, in the third chapter of Ethics of the Fathers, I think it's chapter Mishnah 8, that says, whoever forgets one Mishnah of his studies, it's as though his life is forfeit. Right? Pasuk says, Hishamer lecha pein tishkach. Be, guard yourself lest you forget. So how can it be that forgetting one piece of Torah makes you worthy of death? So the truth is that with the exception of illness-related forgetfulness, as a rule, we forget that which is less important to us. The average person does not need a Palm Pilot to remember the day of his wedding, or to recall the names of his children, because these items should be so important that you can't imagine forgetting them. So if a person can forget a piece of Torah, it means on a certain level that it's not important enough. So what's the antidote to this insidious forgetfulness? He shamer lecha, guard it. Shmira can mean to guard, but it can also mean to cherish. Like when you ask somebody to watch over your child in Israel, you say, shmur alav, take good care of him, because this kid is valuable. He's the most precious possession I have. And that's what the phrase Shmirat Shabbat really means, right? Lishmor Shabbat means to cherish Shabbat, to take care of it, to make it matter. Shmirat Mitzvot doesn't mean to perform mitzvot. It means to cherish them, to see their value. We are living in a generation which has seen us as a people lose touch with what we're all about. We've allowed ourselves to forget who we really are and who we really could be. And this, on a mystical level, was what the angel of Esav injected into the equation when he attacked the Gid HaNasha, the sciatic nerve of Yaakov. Right? He was causing us to forget. And that's why, to this day, we do not eat this nerve, infused as it is with this shikha, this forgetfulness, because although Yaakov ultimately triumphed, he limps with the aftermath of this shikha, this forgetfulness. Right? Just like, I don't know, we were victorious in, you know, the great battle against evil of World War II, but we emerged limping from the struggle of relating to God in a post-Holocaust world. And of course, this was the essence, by the way, of the Greeks' war against the Jews. Right? If you look in the Alanisim prayer that we say, special to Hanukkah, it says, what were they trying to do? Lahashkicham Toratecha. They were trying to make us forget the Torah. Right? They weren't the Romans who were torturing us. They weren't, the Babylonians who were enslaving us. They were inviting us to the games and to the idols and to the parties and to the toga world. They wanted to cause us to forget Torah. Right? And that's why the antidote to the Greek was light, the light of Torah. There's a reason that so many Jews have forgotten the beauty of all the Jewish tradition and Torah have to offer. It's because Judaism and Torah that they see has gotten lost in the dark. And the Judaism that most Jews don't believe in, I don't believe in either, because that perception of Judaism is lacking the light and the beauty that's what Judaism is all about. And you kind of wonder, given the current state of affairs, what would happen if peace really did break out in the Middle East? Most probably it would be a disaster, because Jewish teenagers in Tel Aviv would be filling the bars and the nightclubs with their newfound Arab friends, and the assimilation and intermarriage, which is rampant in America, would come to Israel as well. We'd just be substituting one problem for another. And I guess that's the real challenge we face today. You know, it's not just the struggle, it's understanding what the struggle is about. And as Hanukkah fast approaches, how do we illuminate the darkness of Jewish ignorance and indifference with the light of Jewish pride and education? How do we transform, you know, the gloomy experience of rote and empty ritual to the illuminating excitement of Jewish study and living infused with Jewish meaning? Right? Now that would make for a very bright Hanukkah. And I hope, you know, this is a little food for thought. You have to sort of take a closer look in this week's portion, if you get a chance, at the story of Yaakov and see if you can find sort of the hidden allusions to this idea within the verses of that story.
This presentation by Rabbi Benny Friedman has been brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To access additional presentations from our online media library, order our best-selling books, or learn more about Israelite programming, including seminars, web-based learning, teleconferences, spiritual retreats, Shabbaton experiences, Israel missions, and leadership training, please visit us at www.israelite.org. That's www.israelight.org. You can also call us in New York at 212-947-4990 or in Jerusalem at country code 972-2627-4890. We hope you enjoyed this presentation, and we look forward to learning with you at Israelite.